As all of us have shown, the future is dark. But there is a spark that has been lit. It's been lit in this school and in schools in Chicago and New York and all around the country, indeed all around the world. It's a spark of knowledge, of truth, of justice. It's a spark which everyone here must flame, cause it to illumine the world, that Israel may truly become a light unto the nations.
Well, my colleagues have taken you on a trip into the future. They've laid bare what time holds in store for our world and for our country, for the Jewish people. I can only say humbly, Lo Navi Anochi Velo Ben Navi, I'm not a prophet, I'm not the son of a prophet. No one can clearly describe the role of the future, though the future is not unknown to us. Our science has reached a state sufficient to be able to tell us what will be the basic terms in which the next generation will have to live out its existence. They're fairly well known to all of us. As to population, it'll be too great. As to demography, we'll be clustered in the megalopolis and the great cities. As to technology, we'll be burdened by the terrible possibility of leisure. As to the air that we breathe and the water of our seas and the land in which we rejoice and from which we draw our food, it will not be conserved. Its rich resource will be depleted. We will pass on to the next generation less than was passed on to us. Now, all this can be extrapolated from the present. In the future, when men draw it based on their experience of this day and of the generation immediately before, is painted in gray, if not in nightmare colors. Too many people, clustered in ugly cities which give few of the amenities of life, where alienation and violence are ways of life, an air which is fraught with the grime which kills and destroys prematurely, a life curve which has risen constantly through this past century, but is now at a plateau and is beginning to fall back off again. A life in which we will be bustled and elbowed by many, as desirous as we are of enjoying whatever privilege and whatever opportunity our world can hold in store. That's a possible world. Perhaps the probable future. But there's another possibility, a vague one perhaps, but a possibility nonetheless. And this world would be a world in which man would conserve his natural resource, in which man would plan his families and the family of nations, in which man would use his technology wisely for the good of all, hopefully for the hurt of none, in which ultimate power would not rest in the hands of the few, in which ultimate destruction would not be at the touch of a button in a little black box held by some of the diplomats of the world, in which the possibility of our technology and of our wisdom and of our knowledge would be exploited for the good of the race. That is, for the good of mankind. Now, what is there to be, but what will determine whether we will live in a nightmare world or in a world of some gracious dream? You and I, our will and our wisdom. No man can stimulate another man's will, give him courage, insist on his commitment. We can describe our times as urgent, We can say that we live on the brink, that we're walking a narrow line, that there's only a dim light at the end of the tunnel. You've heard all of these symbols, analogies. But you alone will determine whether you're going to leave off the familiar and the greedy and the lazy and the disinvolved and live a life of larger citizenship. But what I'd like to do this morning is to suggest to this graduating class and to all of you one bit of wisdom which may be helpful as we begin to plan for our future. And I have referenced this morning particularly to the second commandment, the law against idolatry. There are many I know who believe that this commandment is archaic, out of date. There have been very few pagans worshiping very few painted idols, bits of brick and stone, for a long, long time now. And we tend to feel that this part of our history is behind us, that the battle against idolatry has been won. It's hardly begun. The ancient did not worship the sculpted stone. The ancient did not bow before a piece of wood carved in the totem of some animal or some power. He knew that this was simply stone and this was simply wood. He was worshiping a personification of nature. He was worshiping a deification of some virtue. Now, few people personify thunder or lightning or the stars or the sun any longer. We know that all nature is one, that at base energy is one. But most men worship an ideology, something they believe to be ultimately and finally and irrevocably true. Just as the ancients worshiped the goddess of wisdom, or the goddess of truth, or the goddess of love. But when you worship one ideology at the expense of all other wisdom, you turn wisdom into an ugliness, a vulgarity. For in life there is no ultimate truth insofar as man can know that truth. There's only the truth of the unknown God whose wisdom is above and beyond and balances out all of the virtues. Worship wisdom and you fail to live. Worship truth and you can't be lived with. Worship love and there's no strength in you. Worship strength and there's no love in you. Now, what's our danger? What are the gods and goddesses that we worship? The gods and goddesses that will be presented to you in the days and years ahead. There's first the god of country. My country, right or wrong. My country, blindly mine. And then there's the god of revolution. The god of tactics. Uproot, destroy, tear down. And somehow a bolder, brighter, cleaner future will be yours. Well, you may uproot and you may tear down, and all you may have is ruins. And there's the ideology of class, that somehow if the proletariat of the can emerge and come into its own, all things will become well for man. And there's the ideology of class which says, grant to the classes which have the privilege, the right to continue in that privilege, and society will somehow be stable. All of these ideologies are in the marketplace. All of them are seeking your hearts, your souls, and your commitments. When you go to college and you go out into the larger world, all will be there with their promises of utopia. Believe in me. Believe in the revolution. Believe in the new society. Believe in the new truth. Believe in turning out, or believe in turning on. Believe in dropping in, or believe in dropping out. I'll grant you the peace that passeth understanding. I'll give you the world of your dreams. There's no utopia, utopos, no place. There's no solution to the human problem. The more we solve, the more problems arise. There's no ultimate, final truth, the truth known to man. The best that we can do is to use our God-given mind to learn, to experience, to assimilate, to adjust, to balance out, to recognize that the gods whom men worship are man-made gods. But ultimately, we must understand virtue, truth, apply ourselves to that understanding, make up our own minds, avoid dancing as a bacchanalia to any ideology, but commit ourselves in those areas where we are competent. Commit ourselves wholly to the holy struggle for justice, freedom, peace. Perhaps this is the ultimate gift that Judaism can give you. But what do we give you? But faith in the one ineffable God. The God who cannot be described nor defined. The God who is ultimately known but unknowable. Whose attributes no man can define. So when men seek your soul, and they promise you in return for your soul partnership in the crusade which will solve all of man's problems, remember your birth faith. Remember your birthright. Take the good. Take the valuable in every ideology. Take the good, take the valuable in every philosophy. Bring it into your own. But see to it that you worship none but the one God. The God to whom Israel has always been devoted. Amen.